Volume 4, Chapter 27, New England Ready for Independence. In a sense, the situation of Connecticut and Rhode Island was the most clear-cut in the colonies, for these two colonies had been uniquely free of any royal governor or royal arm of government at home. Virtually independent, while colonies, they needed no political or constitutional change to equip them for the struggle with Great Britain, or for possible independence. Hence, with the exception of the ouster of the Tory governor Wanton by the Rhode Island Assembly, there was no need for confrontations or political upheaval. Since Wanton was closely associated with the Hopkins faction, however, his overthrow meant the eclipse of the Hopkinsites and the taking of complete power by the more radical Ward faction. The new governor, Nicholas Cook, was a leading Wardite, as was brilliant young Continental Army General Nathaniel Green, scion of one of the first families of Rhode Island. Rhode Island was galvanized in early November by the burning of Falmouth to denounce the British and to declare it high treason to correspond with, supply, or aid the British forces, a virtual commitment by Rhode Island to American independence. Indeed, in that same month, Samuel Ward, leader of the Ward Party and one of the colony's delegates to the Continental Congress, openly opted for American independence, working tirelessly for that cause from then on. Thus, by the end of 1775, Rhode Island and Connecticut were essentially ready for independence. But the key to New England, of course, was Massachusetts. And if that great spearhead of radicalism would not take the lead for independence, the cause would be lost. While Massachusetts had lost none of its fervor for measures against Britain, its delegation to the Continental Congress was grievously hobbled throughout 1775. Voting in Congress was by province, and hence an elementary requisite for Massachusetts leading a move toward independence was the ability to command the vote of its own delegation. And yet, this the Massachusetts radicals could not do. The Adamses were, of course, two of the brightest stars of the radical firmament, but the conservatives Thomas Cushing and Robert Treat Paine opposed any drive toward independence. The fifth, or swing, member of the delegation was the vain and flighty John Hancock, who clung to his largely honorific post of president of the Continental Congress. He never forgave the Adamses for nominating Washington for army commander-in-chief instead of himself. And, bearing that grudge, he broke with the radicals and veered sharply rightward, allowing himself to be feted by the Dickinsons and Duanes, the luxury-loving Hancock acquired the derisive sobriquet of King Hancock among the radicals. This meant an effective vote of 3-2 against independence, and thus Massachusetts radicalism was stymied. Sam Adams and the frustrated radicals began to threaten openly a separate independent New England, unshackled by the dilatoriness of the other colonies. The critical turning point in this unhappy situation came on December 20, when the Massachusetts Provincial Congress turned Thomas Cushing out as delegate and replaced him with the brilliant young radical and follower of Sam Adams, Elbridge Gerry of Marblehead. This gave the radicals a majority in the Massachusetts delegation, effective the following February when Gerry was to take his seat. Soon afterward, in mid-January, the Massachusetts Congress authorized the delegates to do whatever they thought necessary to establish the right and liberty of the American colonies on a base permanent and secure. Here was a virtual endorsement of American independence.